everyone. I'm Julia.
And I'm Bree.
And welcome to Let's Talk About, the podcast dedicated to exploring your questions and questions you didn't know you had about sex, sexuality, and relationships. Before we get started, a quick thank you to everyone who has submitted a question. Based on the wonderful questions that we've gotten so far and the topics that Bree and I are most interested in, we are planning our future episodes to be focused on the topics of relationships, queer sex, polyamory, and making sex better. We're going to sort the questions that we get into these categories rather than just going through them in order, so we have a slightly more cohesive episodes. And then also on updates, we have an Instagram account now, so you can stay up to date on all of our episodes and when we're releasing them. The account is at letstalkabout_pod_. This is our first main episode, although feel free to go back and check out our mini intro ep where Bree and I shared why we think it's important to talk about sex. But today we're going to dive into all things sexual health. Some of the things we'll discuss are from anonymous questions, and others are just interesting things that Bree and I wanted to talk about.
All right, before we get started, a quick disclaimer, especially since we're talking about sexual health in this episode. Julia and I are aspiring sex educators, with emphasis on aspiring. So although we've got a collection of knowledge from our classes, peer educator jobs, and personal experience, please keep in mind that we are not experts. Whenever we're sharing facts, we'll do our best to let you know where we're getting our information from. But if you're concerned about your health, please see a medical professional. We'll also share a lot about our personal experiences, but remember that we are just two people, and just because we have a shared experience doesn't mean the same holds true for you. So the goal of this podcast is to start these conversations and to encourage you to explore, not find definitive answers to all of your questions. Another note on language, throughout this episode, we will use the term AMAB to reference typical anatomy of people assigned male at birth, and AFAB to reference the typical anatomy of people assigned female at birth. We care about language a lot, and we want to be as precise as possible. So, for example, if we talk about pregnancy, we may say person with a uterus or people who can get pregnant, because not all women have a uterus or can get pregnant, and not all people who can get pregnant are women. We're going to do our best to reference actual anatomy when that's the thing that we're talking about.
Exactly. Thanks, Bree. Okay, let's get into some of these questions. Our first question is it normal for a young adult to experience very low libido? What are some possible causes and solutions to this? So first, key vocab term, libido. That's often thought of as like the sex drive, desire to have sex, related to physical arousal. Bree, do you have anything to add to that?
Nope, that pretty much covers it for me.
Okay, awesome. One key way that I like to think about libido or desire and arousal is through a metaphor that I actually read about in the book Come As You Are, which is written by Emily Nagoski, who is a sex educator, author, and she talks about libido as a gas pedal and a brake pedal. And I think in our pop culture, maybe conversations that you've had, we often think about libido or sex drive as a gas pedal, right? You need to get turned on. It's about how turned on you are, and then when you're maximum turned on, you're ready to go. But there's two factors there, right? You can have this desire and have a lot of factors that are getting you turned on, but you could also have brake pedal factors, things like stress, distractions in the room, anything like that, that could be putting the brakes on a sexual experience, even if you desire and want it a lot. And so I've found this metaphor really helpful in examining my own experiences with when I want to have sex, or maybe I'm working with a partner and we like want to plan out sex, and I'm trying to think, okay, what's gonna make me feel turned on, make me feel like I can fully engage in that experience? And it's really going to be a combination of gas pedal factors, things that make me turned on, whether that's emotional intimacy or physical things that I want us to do as foreplay, or eliminating those brake pedal factors, right? So not only do I need that foreplay, I also need the dishes to be done so I'm not stressed about them, which might seem a little silly, but if that's on your mind when you're trying to initiate sex, it's going to be super distracting and maybe not put you in the right mood. And so thinking about those for this person, if your goal is to increase your sex drive or, you know, maybe have more sex or increase that libido. But just to say it plainly, it is very normal for someone to have a very low libido. That could be something that is just going to be kind of a constant throughout your experience. It could also be something that changes day to day, month to month, depending on what you got going on in your life and what kind of gas pedal or brake pedal factors you're experiencing.
Yeah, and just to clarify here, if I am sitting in a car and I have my foot on the brake, no matter how hard I push on that gas pedal, the car is not going to go anywhere.
Exactly.
So I have to take my foot off the brake in order to be able to go somewhere, which means that I need to identify the things that are getting me to put my foot on the brake. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, cool. All right, so as far as libido goes, there is also something else. This came out of Emily Nagoski's book, Come As You Are, as well. She describes two different kinds of desire. So there's responsive desire, and then there is spontaneous desire. And both of these can also affect libido. So what we often see in media, pop culture, is what we would call spontaneous desire. So, you know, you're walking down the street and all of a sudden it just pops in your mind, oh my gosh, I just want to ravish my partner or the person that I see on the street. And it just spontaneously pops into your head. The problem with that narrative being widely spread is that it is not representative of all of the population. So responsive desire is more like a fire. So you start a kindling and you have a little tiny flame and you have to stoke the flame, get it bigger. And the flame grows in response to what you are doing to it. So let's say that somebody is not interested necessarily, not that they're not interested, but they could have sex or not have sex. They're kind of unsure in that like kind of ambiguous territory. And so your job as the person that would want to have sex would be to cultivate an environment in which the other person could respond to so that their desire could grow from there. Does that make sense to you, Julia?
Yeah. One way that I've thought about this, or one lesson I've taken from this idea of different types of desire, is that sometimes, like, if a partner asks you, hey, do you want to have sex? You might be like, not right now, right? Like, I wasn't even thinking about that. I've got a lot going on, whatever. And so if a partner is just like, hey, do you want to have sex right now? And the narrative that we've seen in movies and stuff is like, that means that you're ripping your clothes off and spontaneously just like getting down. You might be like, no. But another question that I've found helpful in my relationships is like, do you feel like you might want to have sex tonight? Or opening the conversation into what that means, right? There's different types of sex, different attitudes, like, you know, vibes that you might have when you're having sex. You might have a rip your clothes off kind of time, or you might have a more like gentle, slower going like sexual experience with a partner.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So like when my partner and I have sex, sometimes they will be like, hey, you know, like, this is what I'm feeling. I'd like to have sex. And I'm like, you know what? I just got done writing a paper and my brain is like totally somewhere else right now. So even though I theoretically want to have sex, in actuality, my brain is just not there. And so I'll be like, hey, that sounds good. Let me take a shower. And then when I get out of the shower, do you mind giving me a massage to kind of like help bring my body back into itself so that I'm not thinking about the fact that I have to turn in this paper and wait for it to be graded, and I'm really nervous. And just the touching and all of that helps bring me into the moment so that I can actually be present in our sexual activity, which makes it more pleasurable for that person and for myself as well.
Exactly. And I want to clarify, too, for the responsive desire where you do need to warm up and like set the mood maybe more, we're not talking about if you're just not interested in having sex. So if you're not interested and you don't want to have sex, you don't need to put yourself through massages and setting the mood and foreplay to try to build up your desire. You have the absolute right just to not be feeling it. And your sex drive or lack thereof is never a problem if it's not something that's bothering you. So if you are comfortable in having a low desire, that is totally okay. And we don't want to set the tone that you're, you know, should be trying all these things to increase your desire unless that's something that you'd like to experiment with.
Exactly. Yeah. The responsive piece is just, I want to be in the mood for sex and I'm not in the mood for sex. So what can we do to help bring me into the mood for sex? It is completely that person's choice. And I feel like this is kind of a good segue to note that there are people that fall under the umbrella of what is called asexuality. And the desire or the libido for these people under this umbrella, it's not the same for everyone under the umbrella. Some people may experience desire in very specific ways that are not necessarily sexual, but some people just have a lack of sexual desire completely, and that is absolutely okay.
Definitely. So kind of a related question that we had was, is it possible to not be able to orgasm at all or to never achieve orgasm? And the answer is maybe a mix of things. So it's possible. It's definitely possible and very normal to not orgasm in a sexual experience and to need to explore about how to achieve orgasm, whether that's with a partner or by yourself. But it is possible also that there are people out there who may never orgasm and their bodies may just not have that be a possibility. That could be due to medical conditions or certain medicines you're taking. But it's also often, this difficulty to orgasm is also often related to relationship and emotional factors. So we would really like to emphasize that if orgasm is something that you'd like to achieve, or I don't know, achieve is maybe not the language I should be using. That makes it sound like it's like a trophy you get because you orgasmed. But if orgasm is something that you value and makes you feel good and you want to have that, whether by yourself or with a partner, there are ways to explore that. The vast majority of people who experience anorgasmia, which is a kind of the medical term for difficulty or lack of orgasm, it's going to be a lot of factors related to those relationship or emotional factors. So exploring maybe some of the brake pedal things that are maybe causing you to, you know, have a lower desire or lower arousal, the emotional factors, you know, high anxiety can definitely cause difficulty orgasming. I know that's something that I've dealt with a lot. And so exploring those, and we hope this is the goal of this podcast is to like position all of these questions and challenges that people might be having as a journey and encourage you to explore. So if you are trying to reach orgasm, approaching that as an exploration and enjoy the process of trying new things that might help your body reach orgasm.
Yeah, I just also want to throw in there that in my experience, when I am really focused on the outcome of sex, orgasm is completely evasive for me. If my goal is specifically to orgasm and that is super, super what I'm focused on, I oftentimes struggle really hard to get there. Whereas if my goal of this sexual experience is to have fun, to feel pleasure, to bring another person or people pleasure, I am way more likely to experience orgasm under those circumstances.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a mind game, and which can be frustrating at times. But I think being patient with yourself, being patient with a partner and exploring different ways that your body can feel good will help you get there if that's something that's possible and something that you want for yourself. And of course, if this is something that's really bothering you, talk to a doctor about it. There are professionals out there who work with people all the time about this issue. And so, yeah, if it's something that you really value and want to access, then please reach out to someone who can help.
All right, cool. So we have another question that's kind of related to this. How do you reach an orgasm with an overly sensitive clitoris in cases where rubbing or touching can feel like sensory overload in a negative way? First of all, I want to validate this experience because it is one that I have personally shared. So speaking from my own experience, here are some things that have kind of worked for me slash the context of my personal experience with this. So I am a huge fan of the magic wand for clitoris owners out there. If you are feeling adventurous and you have not tried one, I highly, highly recommend it. But the magic wand stimulation is like very specific. It's pretty intense. And I've been using mine for a long time, so I'm kind of used to that type of stimulation. That said, with softer stimulation, like a tongue or gentle fingers, it can produce this like really intense and uncomfortable feeling inside of me that borders on painful. I also get this like weird pulsing in my lower abdomen when that's happening, and it's just really uncomfortable. I have found that the only thing that has worked for me when this is happening is to take more time warming up. So touching around the thighs, touching like the mons pubis area, touching other parts of the vulva before coming to the clitoris. And sometimes people think that warm up takes, you know, 2 minutes, 5 minutes. Sometimes I need like 10, 15 minutes of just touching around that area. Or sometimes I'm like, hey, let's come back to that for me and try it again because it's just so, so sensitive. Another thing that has helped me, especially when I get that weird pulsing in my lower abdomen, is to use my hand or my partner's hand and to press on my lower abdomen. And that kind of like disrupts that pulsing sensation that I'm getting. And also, once you do start touching the clitoris, for me, just gradual touch on the clitoris before like complete full contact is also something that helps. But slow is your friend if you have an oversensitive clitoris.
Okay, I have so many, I don't know, comments, questions. I thought it was really interesting, Bree, that you mentioned like loving the magic wand, but then often that gentler touch, like a tongue or gentle fingers, can be overwhelming. Because for me, I kind of have an opposite thing where the like using a vibrator can be like so overwhelming. And I have always found that like fingers are a better way for me to achieve orgasm or stimulate my clitoris. And it's interesting that you kind of have the opposite experience. I would say another thing that helps me when, I mean, the clitoris has so many freaking nerve endings in it. It makes sense that touching it directly might be overstimulating. Another thing that's helped me is touching over the fabric of underwear, because I find that, that's a gentler feel and kind of distributes the touch a little bit rather than it being like all right there. And if you're with a partner, something that I find helpful is, I think, especially if your partner doesn't have a clitoris, although even if they do, you might have vastly different experiences.
Just like Julia and I do.
Yeah, literally. Is telling them you don't, because I think there's this narrative of find the clit, like focus on the clit, which is awesome. The clit is incredible for pleasure, at least in so many people's experiences, including my own. But also, it can be a really overwhelming. And if someone just kind of like goes in and attacks the clit, it's going to hurt a little bit. So focusing on the area around that, because there's so many nerve endings in that area. And I think that's like what Bree mentioned, like focusing on the surrounding area and taking your time.
Yeah, that warm up is like really important. And also, I want to mention that the part that we call the clitoris is actually the clitoral bulb. So your clitoris extends further into your body. So if you are at home and you're feeling like exploring a little bit, right above that clitoral bulb, you're going to feel almost like a tube underneath of the skin. That little piece is also part of your clitoris. And so when I'm warming up, I like to move my hand or my partner's hand back and forth across that before I touch the actual bulb of the clitoris. And that helps kind of desensitize me a little bit and get me ready for having my clitoral bulb engaged.
Yeah, that's such a good point, Bree. And the clitoris extends further into your body and back towards the vagina. So focusing on the clit doesn't mean that you're just in that small visible bulb. You can stimulate the whole area of the vulva and the clit is going to be feeling things too.
100%. All right. So next question. Is it normal for a woman to not produce much or hardly any lubricant even when she is excited to be having sex with her partner? This is so
yes.
normal.
Yeah.
This is so normal. This is why lubricant exists, right? It's really important, too, to make sure that we are well lubricated because this prevents vaginal tearing. This prevents tearing of condoms. And overall, it just makes things more pleasurable if you have lots of lube. And please, please, please don't judge your bodies for not creating enough lubricant or behaving in a way that you feel your body should behave. It is just doing its own body thing. So something that I wanted to touch on here was, again, back to Emily Nagoski, because she is so, so smart.
We love her.
Yes, we just love her. So she talks about a concept called arousal non-concordance. And basically what that means is that sometimes our bodies, the physiological process of our bodies do not match our mental state. So one of the ways that she describes this in her book is people becoming physically aroused to sexual mental stimulation that they do not find exciting. So in the case of something like sexual assault, people lubricating, and even though they did not want to have that experience or were not enjoying that experience, this also works in reverse. So you may be completely turned on for having this experience with your partner and really ready to go, and your body is just not matching up with that. So that's what arousal non-concordance is. And I encourage you to do a little bit of research on this because it might just help you feel a little less judgmental and more in tune with your body.
Yeah, I loved when I read that in the book. It was so liberating, I think. We often talk about sex in, like, I don't know, a common phrase that I hear is, oh, like, you're so wet or she's so wet, which we know now is not an indicator of how emotionally aroused or how much someone wants to be having sex. So knowing that is super liberating, and take advantage of lubricant that you can buy at the store, or if you're on campus, get for free in one of our safer sex spots, because it exists for a reason.
Absolutely. Absolutely. No shame in wanting some extra glide.
Yeah. And so kind of related to this, you know, trying to have sex without lubricant, whether that's natural or store-bought, can be pretty painful. But we did get a question about vaginismus. The question is, what is vaginismus and how do I cope with it? So for anyone hearing, for the question asker and for anyone hearing this word for the first time, vaginismus is a spontaneous tightening of the muscles around the vagina. And I mentioned in our mini intro episode that the first time that I had sex, it was really painful. And after talking to a doctor, I think they diagnosed me with dyspareunia, which is basically just a medical term for recurrent genital pain during intercourse. So painful sex. this dyspareunia can be something that someone has because of vaginismus, because of tightening of the muscles during intercourse. It can also be from a variety of other things. But for me, this was definitely related to muscle tightness in the pelvic floor. We use the term pelvic floor for just like all the muscles down there. They're all super connected, especially the muscles around the vagina. So if someone has vaginismus, it can be really painful to have like penis and vagina sex or, you know, penetrative intercourse. It can also be painful to do things like try to insert a tampon or insert a sex toy, a finger, or even getting a pelvic exam, like going to the gynecologist. This is something that I dealt with the first time I tried to use tampons, I don't know, a long time ago. It was super painful. I tried really hard to make it work for me. And I, like, some days can use them great. Some days I'm like, ow, it's not happening. And then obviously had the same pain during intercourse.
Can I jump in real quick?
Yes, absolutely.
In speaking of getting a pelvic exam, this is just something that I thought of. Did you know that they have different sized speculums?
Yes, I only do because, man, have I had so many conversations because of my own pain.
Oh my gosh. Every time I go to get a pelvic exam, they always try and start with a medium sized speculum, and I need a small speculum. And it was not until the last 6 months that I realized I could have been requesting a small speculum since I started getting pelvic exams. So please, if you are experiencing pain when having a speculum inserted into your vagina, ask for a smaller speculum.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, well, it's funny, I mentioned on that intro episode that I actually talked to my mom about the pain I was having, and she was like, they have child size, like they have like pediatric speculums, and you could ask for one of those. And I don't know, they won't always have all of them available, but you can ask for what you need. And if your doctor is not going to take you seriously, get a new doctor, because you deserve to have someone who will listen to you. So back to vaginismus, it can arise from a variety of things. So it could come up because of physical trauma to the pelvic floor muscles. I was reading about it, and some people will have vaginismus after like traumatic childbirth experiences, because your pelvic floor goes through a lot when you're birthing a child. But it could also be due to things like psychological or emotional factors. So things like stress or sexual anxiety can cause those muscles to tighten up. There's a huge connection between psychological and physiological here. And so experiencing something traumatic or anxiety-inducing could then lead to those muscles tightening up and leading to vaginismus and dyspareunia, pain during sex.
That's so interesting. So what is somebody that is experiencing these kinds of things supposed to do? Like what happens?
Yeah, so glad you asked, Bree. There's a lot of options, and we can't say which is going to be right for you. So I encourage you to talk to a doctor about these if it's something that you're trying to address. But one route that you could go is that kind of physical, physiological, or medical route. So there are actually people who are called pelvic floor physical therapists, or you might have like pelvic physical therapy. And they are physical therapists dedicated to everything going on in your pelvic floor. They can work with people who have dyspareunia, have vaginismus, and help work with those muscles to see what's going on and to see how you can get those muscles to relax. So this can be things like, it can be things like stretches. I actually went to pelvic floor PT. I went to pelvic floor PT, I think it was about once a week or every other week for quite a few months. And I had a lovely PT. And I was super nervous going in because, what the heck, I'm having pain during sex. This isn't something that, you know, our society talks about. And I was really nervous about what might happen. And one of the things that they do is actually like insert their fingers into the vagina and gently press on the walls of the vagina to kind of gently stretch those muscles, which, really intimate, kind of nerve-wracking, but they're not going to jump right into that without warning you, without having a conversation about if that's something that you want to try. But that for me was something that I wanted to try. And I'd actually had a friend who told me that they did the same exact thing, which was so cool because it made me super less nervous to do that. You can also do stretches, normal everyday stretches, to stretch like your glutes, your lower back, things like that, because all those muscles are connected. And so relaxing your body and the muscles in that area is going to help.
So are you saying that yoga could help my pelvic floor?
Yes, I'm saying that yoga could help your pelvic floor.
Love it.
Yeah, it's awesome. And then back to actually stretching the muscles like directly around the vagina, there are things called dilators. Free, have you heard of these before?
I have.
Okay, awesome. For anyone listening, dilators are, I don't know, I think of them as kind of like medical dildos, which, I don't know, maybe my pelvic PT is going to be mad at me for saying that. But they are kind of like, how should I describe this? They come in a variety of sizes, and they are meant for you to insert into the vagina, and they gently stretch those muscles. So I started with a dilator that was like the size of a pinky, and I cracked up when I saw it and said, I'm spending money on this. It was kind of hilarious. And then they go up in size gradually, so you can insert them into the vagina and stretch those muscles.
So pop culture reference, if anybody here has seen the show Sex Education on Netflix, there is actually a character that goes through this process of using the dilators. I believe their name is Lily. So if you want just kind of like a fun way to expose yourself to this, that would be a route to do it.
Dude, I forgot about that. And yes, I loved when I watched that episode because it was so nice to see this being represented, because it's something that remarkably a lot more people go through than you'd think if you haven't had a friend open up about it before. There are those dilators that you can use them with a medical professional, like the pelvic floor physical therapist. You can also kind of take them home, buy them, do it yourself. Definitely recommend like reading up on it and doing it carefully, because you don't want to cause trauma to those muscles. You want to be very gentle in how you do this. It's a very slow process of getting those muscles used to relaxing. And then there's also options like numbing cream. Personally, I'm not for this option. For me, I'm like, if I have to kind of numb the area in order to make this happen, I'm just not going to force it. But if you have something like pain right at the entrance of the vagina, you could put on a little numbing cream, then allow for that penetration to happen. But make sure you're doing this gently and with the guidance of a medical professional. And then, so that's all kind of physical, medical options. There's just a lot of behavioral decisions you can make also. So with a lot of sexual dysfunction issues, they're often not problems unless they're bothering you. So if you are not being bothered by having tight muscles down there, then it's okay. Like, for example, with dilators, there's no size that you have to get up to. It's just you choosing to go up to a size of dilator that means your muscles are comfortable with whatever activity you're engaging with. So comfortable during penetrative intercourse with a partner, comfortable putting a tampon in, comfortable at the gynecologist with a speculum, whatever that looks like for you. You can also work with your partner to discuss what things feel good during sex and which things are must-haves versus wants. So Bree and I have talked about this a bunch of times, but we like the metaphor of a menu for sex. So maybe penetrative sex is super painful for you. If it's something that you want to have and that you and your partner have identified as something that is kind of a need, or you really, really want it during sex, that's awesome. You can work on that, like pelvic PT, things like that. Maybe there are other things that you want to try. Maybe oral sex feels better. Maybe there's other ways that you can stimulate that area without having the penetration that was causing pain. And then another thing that I have found is that if you do want to have penetrative sex, or like penis and vagina sex, I've found that having an orgasm first, so having an orgasm from direct clitoral stimulation can be really helpful because then after an orgasm, I find that my muscles are much more relaxed. And so when those muscles are relaxed, then you can maybe try to have that penetration after you've already had an orgasm. Lots of things to try there. And then the last thing I'll say, there is a side of this that's also emotional coping. And Brie, I like that you mentioned sex education. Love that show for so many reasons. But seeing other people go through this and normalizing it for you, for yourself, might be really helpful. It was for me, whether that's like reading about other people's experiences. I actually spent some time on Reddit, which is funny, but there's a whole community of people who experience vaginismus and are working through it. Some of it, you know, is hard to read because people do have a lot of challenge with these things, but knowing that people are experiencing similar things was really helpful for me. And then also emotional coping with your partner. So if you are in a sexual relationship and that's where these issues are arising, then making sure that they're on the same page and understand what you're going through.
Thank you so much, Julia, for sharing this experience. It was really eye-opening for me to listen to. So, and I'm sure that you have helped at least one person feel slightly less alone, which is the whole point and why we're here.
That's the goal. Thank you, Brie.
Yeah. All right. So we just went over some really cool stuff and had some in-depth conversations about some of these awesome questions that we've been given. The next few questions, we're going to do kind of like a rapid fire thing. So we're not going to go quite as in-depth with these questions. The next question is, should you pee after using a sex toy? The short answer is yes. Please pee after any kind of sexual activity that could introduce bacteria into the vaginal canal. This includes both penetration and oral.
Yeah. Peeing kind of clears out like the urethra. So we are just in the game of preventing UTIs here. Any activity down there, peeing is a good idea. There's no hard and fast rules, but it will probably help you out.
Yeah, you don't have to like force yourself to pee. Like, don't give yourself a hemorrhoid like pushing down while on the toilet. But if you have to pee, please pee.
Yeah, good answer. Okay, next question. Is it true that your testicles have taste receptors? Now, I read this question and I was like, where did this come from? I know nothing about this. After a quick Google search, found that this was information, it was spread a lot on Reddit, although there are a few other articles that popped up as well. But people were on Reddit saying, today I learned that your testicles have taste buds or taste receptors. Short answer is kind of yes and no. Yes, there are receptors in testicles that can detect things like sweetness and what we call like umami flavor. So they can detect those, but they're not functioning in the same way that your taste buds are functioning on your tongue. Obviously, I hope. The sweet and umami receptors are important to detect things like sugars and amino acids, which are both connected to sperm production. But this is happening outside of our taste system because taste is about the process of your brain sensing flavors. Of course, your testicles aren't sending the same messages to your brain that your taste buds would. You're not actually going to taste the flavors. But there are receptors that function kind of similarly in how they receive those messages. Then they put them into action for sperm production.
That's so interesting.
Next question is, do guys have a G-spot? If you don't know, the G-spot is a spot in the vagina that's a couple inches up on the front wall of the vagina. And it's often known as somewhere that is more pleasing to be stimulated. People can stimulate that area with a sex toy, a penis, fingers, and is kind of known as the place to have pleasure in the vagina.
Yeah, so like if a person that owns a vagina is lying on their back and another person inserts the fingers into the vagina and makes like a come hither motion, that's where you should be able to kind of feel that.
Yeah. This question's asking, do guys have a G-spot? They don't have the same kind of G-spot, but they do have a prostate. People with a prostate, that's something that you'll be able to feel in the anus. the same kind of come hither motion works because it's on the front wall or like behind the front wall of the anus.
Small disclaimer, you can hurt someone by stimulating the prostate incorrectly. So if you are planning to do this with a partner, please do some research. Again, talk to a medical professional or look up reputable sources on the internet before you do this, because you do not want to harm your partner while trying to give them pleasure.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's a lot to anal sex or stimulating the prostate that we're not going to get into today. But because of the language around the G-spot, sometimes the prostate has been coined the P-spot. Really, there's a lot of spots on our bodies that give us pleasure, and I guess these happen to be more similar than other ones, but not a G-spot, but the P-spot.
All right, cool. And our last little rapid-fire question that we've got here is, can females have an orgasm when having anal sex, or is that only for males? So some vulva owners say yes. Orgasm can happen from many different kinds of stimulation, such as nipple stimulation, which is cool and something I would like to try. But the theory behind the anal orgasm is that the G-spot is hit from the other side. So it's indirect stimulation to the internal part of the clitoris, because as Julia mentioned earlier in this episode, the clitoris is more than just that little bulb that we see on the outside. It expands inside of the body.
Yeah, exactly. If you're having anal sex, all those nerve endings could still be stimulated from the clitoris. And then also there's just a bunch of nerve endings in the anus as well. So that can bring you pleasure. And sometimes that pleasure might bring on an orgasm.
And one final thing about this, we often think of orgasm as like a physiological process, but really orgasm is something that happens in our brain, which is why some people can experience orgasm through nipple stimulation or through other types of stimulation. When we reframe it like that, this is one of those things that can help expand our menus when we look outside of what is traditionally associated with an orgasm. So yeah,
exactly.
Turn those brains on.
We're gonna get into some longer questions again. This next question is, my partner has trouble staying hard once a condom is on. How can I help him keep an erection so we can go further? First, we wanna emphasize that for any like AMAP people with a penis, losing an erection at any point during sexual activity is completely normal. It's super common. It might happen to you a lot. It might happen to you randomly. But Bree and I both wanted to talk a little bit about some experiences that we've had with partners about this as well. The first time I had sex, just because it was brand new and because I had some pain with it, it took us a long time to like get going, I guess. It took us a long time to like start penetration. And so just because of the amount of time that took, my partner lost his erection, and that's completely normal.
Yeah, and so I think I've had maybe a little bit more experience with this than Julia has had. I've mentioned I'm a non-traditional student, so I'm going to go ahead and date myself. Actually, as of today, I am 32 years old.
Happy birthday, Brie.
Thank you. So I've had quite a few partners in my sexual history that have owned penises that are attached to their body, to be fair. And with every single one of my partners that own a penis, we have come across the loss of an erection. When we're saying it's normal, it is really, really normal and really, really common. And what I've found is the biggest barrier to restoring an erection when something like this happens is the internalized shame of the penis haver. And the best way that I've experienced overcoming it is talking about it. Reassurance, open conversation, these things can go a long way in helping a partner to relax. And that can allow the physiological processes that create an erection to kind of like come back online. Because if you're sitting there and you're panicking about the fact that you have lost your erection, you are completely detaching and dissociating from the sexual experience in the moment. And I also want to point out, if an erection doesn't come back, that's okay. There are a lot of ways to experience pleasure that do not require an erect penis. So if this happens, look at it as an opportunity to expand your menu of
sexual options and ways to achieve pleasure. I do want to point out, too, that there are some physiological barriers to keeping an erection, and if this is something that you believe you're experiencing, you should speak with a medical professional about this. All right. Our final question is, if you get cold sores and you kiss someone, but you don't have one that day or whatnot, can that person then have cold sores now, too? Or can a person solely have a cold sore if they kiss you while you have one? Okay, this is related to HSV, herpes simplex virus. And there, unfortunately, is so much misinformation about this particular STI. I feel very passionately about educating people properly about STIs. And I also feel very, very passionately about STI stigmatization because I think it's something that is incredibly unhelpful and ultimately contributes to the spread of STIs. So I'm gonna kind of go off on a tangent
here. Yeah, and Bree knows a lot more about this than I do. So I'm going to be learning as Bree shares a bunch of information about this too. I'll probably have some questions as you go, Bree.
Sweet. Okay, first of all, many carriers of HSV are asymptomatic, which means that they do not exhibit any kind of symptoms. So you can have herpes without ever having a cold sore or a genital sore. Second is that what we call HSV-1 or herpes simplex virus 1 is related to oral herpes, whereas HSV-2 is related to genital herpes. But what a lot of people don't know is that either of these viruses, HSV-1 or HSV-2, can infect either area. So, for example, you can have HSV-2 on your mouth and you can have HSV-1 on your genitals. So HSV goes through what is called a shedding cycle. And what that means is that the virus is shedding itself off of the body. And people can pick up the virus when it's shedding off the body. And unfortunately, there is no like visible sign of the shedding. And a lot of people that are asymptomatic, or all people that are asymptomatic, still go through a shedding cycle.
Okay, so having a cold sore doesn't mean that that's when you're shedding the virus?
You're shedding the virus more than likely when you have a cold sore.
Okay.
And even when you don't have a cold sore, you can still be shedding the virus.
Got it.
Yeah. So these shedding cycles are individual and it's different from person to person. However, there are estimates of like how long these cycles last and when they affect people, like during a 30-day period. And you can find this information through the National Institute of Health or through the CDC. Those are reputable sources to look for that kind of information. Use of antiviral medication, I believe the common one is acyclovir, that can help to reduce the length of the shedding cycle. So it makes transmission less likely. However, you're still going to go through a shedding cycle.
And it's not going to like cure you of the HSV? Okay.
There is no cure for HSV-1 or HSV-2, just the antiviral medications that kind of lessen the viral load to the point of where you're very much less likely to transmit it, but you still can, to be sure. Yeah. So another thing that I want to point out with HSV is that it's common. Like, it's ridiculously common. Like I said, so many people don't even know that they have HSV because they themselves are asymptomatic. And something that a lot of people don't know is that when you go to get tested for STIs, they do not test you for HSV.
Why
one
not?
Or two. Because it's not really seen as that important. It's not gonna kill you unless it's prenatally. So like if you're giving birth to a baby and you have HSV-2, for example, that's when it becomes dangerous to the baby. But in that case, they can just do a C-section and that kind of like gets around the problem. But yeah, you're not tested in just a regular full panel STI screening unless you specifically ask your doctor to test you.
Okay.
Yeah. Again, since this is super common, you can go again to the National Institute of Health or to the CDC and figure out what are, like, how many people are infected with this, at least estimations of this, and what do transmission rates look like for people that are not medicated with antivirals versus people that are medicated with antivirals, because the transmission rates vary. The biggest thing here, please talk to your doctor if you or your partner have or are concerned about HSV and its transmission. Another thing that I want to know, HSV, specifically HSV2, genital herpes, is the second most stigmatized STI behind HIV.
Wow.
Yeah. And I also want to point out that the stigmatization is relatively new. It's actually only about 40 years old. We're going to go ahead and make a link available to a zine that I created that describes the history of HSV stigma. So you'll be able to take a closer look at that if you find yourself interested.
That's awesome, Bree. Thank you for making that and doing all of the research about this.
Absolutely. And a final note, and why I feel so passionately about this, is that HSV stigma has led people to believe that those that carry this virus are unlovable or will never have another sexual partner. And this is just not true. Please, even if you are not infected with HSV, learn what you can about the viruses and do your part in dismantling stigma. And this means moving away from jokes about herpes and stuff like that, because that colloquial language can be really harmful and perpetuate just incorrect ideas about what herpes actually is.
Yeah, absolutely. So Bree just mentioned the zine that they made, and we're going to link to that on our Instagram along with other resources like the sources for some of the information that we shared today. Check that out at letstalkabout_pod_. Also, keep your questions coming. The link to that anonymous question form is in the episode description, and it will be in our Instagram bio as well.
And like we mentioned at the beginning, we are hoping to dedicate our future episodes to the themes of relationships, queer sex, polyamory, and making sex better. Also, if you're enjoying this, please share it with a friend.
Yeah, we'd love to get this out to more people. And then lastly, our music was produced by my friend Chris. You can check out their work on Instagram at TheKillChris. That's TheKill, C-R-I-S. We are so excited to learn with y'all this term. See you next time.
Bye.